I have to say, it's brilliant to welcome Jim Carrington, who's a local broadcaster. We worked on another station together before, but it's nice to sort of have him face to face in front of me on a Sunday morning. Nice to see you here, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Sunday paper review for us today.
Yes.
Something you've never done before, but I'm sure, knowing you, you're going to be very good at it. What do you...
Well, you know, I don't normally read any newspaper, let alone a Sunday paper, so it's a bit of a challenge for me.
So what are you going to fire off with this first?
Right, well, I'm nothing original here, and being a football fan, because when I used to read the Sunday papers as a lad, that actually meant going straight to the back page and looking at the football results and seeing how all the teams had done.
Skip the rest of the paper.
Yeah, I never went any further forward than the football, really. So it has to be Suarez, I think. If this is repeating what everyone else has said, but it's interesting to see that two newspapers have got exactly the same headline, which is "Who needs Suarez?" Because yesterday Liverpool had a fantastic 6-0 away win at Newcastle. And I don't know. I think that Liverpool is a great club. I'm not a Liverpool fan, by the way, but I think they're a great club. They have a good reputation. Everyone has a lot of respect for them. And should they be keeping him, really? Well, I think it's a sign of the times at Liverpool that they are keeping him, or they claim they're going to. But it does feel like a bit of a compromise to me. And what I would really love to see is Liverpool showing over the next few games how they can manage without this one player, mm-hmm. and strengthen the team. Yeah, if they did lose him, I'm sure they'd get a few pounds for him, and maybe they'd be able to find someone else, maybe not Andy Carroll this time, find another good player and bring in the squads. It's just it's a shame, I think, with so much money in the game and so much pressure on the teams to do well, that a club like Liverpool probably feels they can't really afford to lose a player like that, despite, you know, their own principles and their own morals.
Do you think the side's been suppressed by Suarez in, say, the dressing room, when they socialise, when they're out on the training fields? Are they somehow, as you say, they sparked a 6-0 win yesterday. It does make you wonder whether almost a psychological load is being taken off the backs of the rest of the team.
Yes, I don't know what the man's actually like, sort of on the training ground, whether he's a good laugh and a great member of the squad. Sometimes these fantastic individuals are not that good for team spirit, but I know nothing about Suarez and what the effect is on the rest of the team like that. But maybe it has given the rest of the team a chance to think, well, yeah, let's go and show what we can do.
It'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall, wouldn't it?
You know, it would.
In training sessions.
And of course, it changed, without getting too technical, it does change the shape of the game when a key player like that is not there. You know, everybody adjusts new positions, and it does give other people a chance. But it was quite a strange incident last week, really, watching that on television.
It's bizarre, absolutely bizarre behaviour. But in context, you can do a two-footed challenge and put a player out or ruin his career, and you may not get as long as that.
Yes, that is absolutely true. But even the Prime Minister got involved in this one, didn't he?
Well, I think the referee actually saw it, because the referee, I don't think, could comprehend within anything that's credible that something like this could happen, that somebody could bite someone. It's just outside of the realms of possibility, I guess.
I think Suarez has a bit of a record, not only at biting, but other behaviours that maybe we don't want to encourage. Anyway, maybe enough of him, but let's see what happens to Liverpool. And I think for their sake, it would be nice if they had a good end to the season on the pitch without their star player. It's also a bit miserable for a Sunday morning, but there seem to be a few of the old pitch invasions and that side of football creeping back in. Wolves, I believe, yesterday was there. They're probably going to get relegated.
They were a bit naughty. Going back to Brentford again, they were a bit naughty in the crowds.
No.
Yes. The peasants were revolting yesterday.
Oh, no way.
A little bit, yes.
Yes, they were winding one of the opposition players. Oh, that goes with the territory. Come on.
I'm actually a supporter of a non-league team, and when I was a teenager, I used to go down to see my team, which is Wealdstone in North London.
Wealdstone?
Yeah, I used to go and see them play nearly every week, and there it really is sort of... you can hear every word that every supporter is shouting. The abuse is absolutely horrendous.
Well, you and the other supporters.
Me,
yeah, that
both
was the pitch invasion. Two
and
of you.
The four players get singled out by the crowd. You know, someone who's maybe deemed to be a little overweight, for example, will get all sorts of abuse.
Quite nearby to Harrow. Obviously, they were sort of oh, them up there, those posh ones, is it?
Harrow Borough with the local rivals.
And Wealdstone sort of just a couple of miles down the road.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
The lower end.
So actually the club where Stuart Pearce and Vinnie Jones started their careers.
Wealdstone?
Yeah, and wow. Yeah, maybe Vinnie Jones wasn't a great example
no,
to the club either.
No.
But anyway, yes, the football season, of course, hotting up. Yes, moving on to other subjects, I found an article about fridges being automatically switched off in the future, possibly. This is in the Mail on Sunday,
yes.
And it's a means of, well, sort of balancing supply and demand, I suppose, for energy, which energy, obviously, and electricity, something that... we have to keep an eye on, and the prices we're always worried about. And this is idea that they will fit smart chips to household appliances like fridges, washing machines, ovens, so that at times when the national grid is struggling to meet the demand, they'll be able to automatically switch off some of these devices in people's homes just for a few seconds.
They say the national grid is so close to sometimes going to a brownout in winter. This is an American phrase, isn't it, where we actually have to have power cuts on some parts of the grid simply because we haven't got the generating capacity anymore. And they're saying that within 2 years it could be a very serious situation with more power stations being decommissioned but without the generating capacity that we need to continue. So this is a bit worrying, isn't it? But How will they actually have entry to someone's kitchen or home to say, I'm coming in right now with this new chip because we're going to automate your fridge to switch itself off?
Yes, I mean, the smart chip will be fitted to new fridges.
And
I think the idea is that it might become regulation that all new appliances would have to be fitted with a chip. They're looking at a cost at the moment, and maybe it's too early to say this really, of maybe £40 added on to the price of these appliances. Which
as much as that?
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
As one who knows a little bit about electronics, I have to say that that's a little bit of a steep inflation on
I'd like to think. I like to think that figure's going to come down. Maybe a little bit of scaremongering, but also, of course, technology does tend to get cheaper, doesn't it, with things like this. They say there's actually an island, a Danish island called Bornholm, where they do a lot of experiments along these lines of how to manage energy. And one of the things they do there, or they're planning to do at least, is they have a lot of electric cars there, or maybe it's even going to be the only type of car, I don't know, they're going to have there. And of course electric cars have to be plugged in and charged, and the idea would be at times when demand is low, that's when the cars would get charged. So if you plug your car in, maybe in the middle of the night or something like that, then the charging will be going on. And if at a time of high demand, if you still got your car plugged in, then the grid can actually pull some electricity back again out of the car.
So what happens if you're on your way to work and it's a particularly cold day and batteries are not very good in the cold and you do need a charge because you've done 5 miles and you've got still another 10 to go and you can't charge your electric vehicle?
I don't think they thought of that one, Phil. You spotted a fly in the ointment. But yeah, it's interesting. It's good to hear how people are, you know, trying to think of how to manage energy supply. There's, you know, the word the Big Brother appearing here, but I don't think I really mind Big Brother being in my fridge if he's just there to turn it off. He's not checking on what's in my fridge. He's just switching things on and off every now and again.
I'm all for being eco and green, but have you actually seen an electric car on the streets of Cambridge yet? I have to say, not even there are very, very, very few of them out there. I'm not scornful of the technology. I still don't believe it's ready yet. It's still got a long way to go to get the range on the vehicles. But you just still do not see these vehicles about on the streets yet in any number at all, do you?
No, a few hybrid cars, I think.
The Priuses, the Leafs.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that's something that is going to take off. I think it's just a matter of time, really. Can I keep going?
Yeah, go on, please do, yeah. Don't run out now. Don't let your battery run down. We'll have to put you into a charging point.
Big Ben, I always wondered, you know, people say, well, Big Ben is like the definition of time in the UK, and you know, when Big Ben chimes, that's exactly o'clock and everything like that. And I always wondered how we could have our time driven by an old clock like that. That's just me being naive. I'm sure nobody else ever thought that.
It's not gone electric yet.
But it turns out that the way they keep it on time is by ringing up the speaking clock.
Oh, really? Well, okay.
They rang up a bill of £680 calling the service last year.
My goodness, because I know it's regulated on old pennies as well, isn't it? They actually leave those underneath a pendulum so that it swings at a certain speed, and if they have to take a penny off to slightly lighten it to bring the pendulum speed up slightly or slow it down, and that's the way it's done.
There must be a cheaper way of doing this, surely.
But it's old. It's an old, old clock.
No. Without ringing the speaking clock, there must be, a radio-controlled device.
I imagine
or
if you
something.
Are engineers around here now, if they're listening, they'll say, oh, well, why don't they use this system on a piece of software which is linked to the internet, which synchronises everything,
quite.
So it's accurate to the second.
Well, if you're saying that they're still using old pennies and things like that, and I think speaking clock's quite high-tech in comparison, so they're getting there.
That's been around since the late 1960s, early 1970s, in its own right, anyway.
The lady called Sara Mendes da Costa is apparently the voice of the speaking clock. Okay. She's 46 years old, and she says, for the absolute accurate time, the speaking clock is the one to go by.
Well, she would say that, really.
She would, wouldn't she? Yeah, keep herself in a job.
Give her some paid work.
Interesting to see Boris Johnson on the front page again.
What's this with a very white rabbit?
Rabbit,
Well, somebody in a white rabbit costume.
Well, nothing really surprises me when I see I'm just surprised it's not him inside the costume, to be honest. This is him going along to a campaign, I think, against the third runway at Heathrow, and it's a wildlife campaigner dressed up as a big rabbit.
White
rabbit standing next to him. But the article's also talking about how David Cameron is ready to let or encourage Boris Johnson to run to be an MP at the next election, again, as well as being the Mayor of London, and saying all sorts of nice things about him, saying he can do anything, that's a moral story of Boris. And asked whether Johnson could become Prime Minister, he replied, I'd never want to put a limit on what Boris can achieve. I think he's a fascinating person, Boris Johnson. I have no idea what he's like in real life and behind the scenes
him fascinating too. I mean, highly amusing sometimes. And some of the words and the expressions and phrases he comes out with is...
I consider him... I mean, I'm not a political person. I don't know what goes on there, really. But he's very entertaining. But I'm not sure I'd trust him with the country.
I don't know, just by his nature, he's a bit of a lampoon. But I don't mean to be personal about him, or again, to be, you know, I'm not saying it from
a political
angle.
But I think that makes
him
quite lovable, and I think that's why he gets the votes.
Yes.
There's
a certain charisma there as well.
There's a programme on television, which you may know, called Who Do You Think You Are, I think, when people go and trace their family history.
Yeah.
And he was on that.
Yes.
And I would say it was one of the most entertaining episodes I've seen. And one of the things I loved about him is that he didn't do all this getting emotional and things like that. Everything was just... He treated everything so lightheartedly and it's just such a fun sort of thing. And it was a good laugh. And
he's from Turkish ancestry.
That's right, yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah, and some connections with royal family and all sorts. Mm. Fascinating character. Well, that's nearly everything. I want to just bring up a local story, though, if I may.
Yeah, one more,
This was something, it was in the paper about 3 or 4 weeks ago. It was in the free newspapers, you might have seen. It was the story of the shortest yellow lines in the country, or double yellow lines in the country.
Oh, hang on, this is in Swindon or somewhere, though, wasn't it?
Is that Humberston Road, Cambridge?
Oh, the shortest one, yes. The one on the narrowest street, that goes to... that we can afford that honour to Swindon.
Swindon.
Yes, the narrow... Yes, I did see that story.
Oh,
it's less
no.
than a foot long, isn't it?
Yes, 11 inches long.
Yes.
And the thing that made me laugh about this was there was a quote from a local councillor who said he's hoping that... I hope this is tongue-in-cheek. Hoping that it will attract tourists to the road. Does he think it's going to be a boom to the local economy? The people are going to come and look at these double yellow lines and want refreshments or
wasn't even a single line, sort of a restricted access, sort of restrictions at certain times of day, was it? It was double yellow, to make sure of. Surprise, it wasn't made of red route, actually.
there is actually some logic to it. I thought it was just ridiculous, but apparently there's a disabled parking spot there. And they basically don't want any... It's a way of sort of isolating it from the rest of the residence parking, I assume. And so you've got your little one bay there for the...
For length.
For length. And then there's two sets of double yellow lines, one either side, very short, just to keep the people in the neighbouring bays out. There is some logic there.
Yeah. Well, thanks for finding some happy stories for us this morning, Jim. Some light-hearted ones, at least we can kind of laugh along, because there's always just so much gloom and doom, as we've had and we've said with other paper reviewers. I mean, because we can't help it. That's, you know, they're all good paper reviewers, but it's very difficult to sort of drill down and rake up some good stories for us this morning. So thanks very much for that. Highly entertaining.
Thank you, Phil.
Lovely to see Jim Carrington with us this morning, and thanks very much for that.
Make us number one on your radio preset. We are Cambridge 105.
Lovely to welcome our next guest into the mix this morning, into the fray, into the lovely fray that's Sunday Breakfast from Cambridge 105. We welcome Anna Ellis. She works for the Voluntary Services Department for Addenbrookes Hospital. Nice to see you here.
Hello,
good morning to you. Now, I do know you because, shall we say, we have certain voluntary capacities going on ourselves without revealing too much about what that might be. So I suppose I would have approached you knowing a little bit about you, but I approach it from a listener's point of view where they probably won't really know too much about what goes on there. But one fact I have given them a little bit earlier on today, there are something like 700 volunteers at the moment actually placed with you, aren't there?
There are, yes. There's about 7,000 staff at Addenbrookes and about 700 volunteers. So that's a large volunteer team we've got there. We've got about 400 with our voluntary, the general volunteer team. And then we have our partner organisations that work with us, and there are about 300 volunteers at the hospital working with our partner organisations. I can't list them all, but for example, we've got WRVS, we've got Maggie's Wallace Cancer Care, we've got Radio Addenbrookes, of course, we've got the Red Cross, Chaplaincy, we've got Pets as Therapy, which are the pat dogs that are very popular for patients and visitors on the ward. So there are lots and lots of different ways to volunteer at Addenbrookes.
10% of the total, so we say, staff makeup then are volunteers.
Absolutely,
700,
yeah.
Over 7,000.
So, yes.
7,000 employees, that makes Addenbrookes the largest employer in Cambridge, doesn't it, I believe, as it, well? That's another fact.
It probably is, yeah. I know the year it was opened on our site. Do you know that one, Phil?
Oh, a little bit of history. Cambridge quiz. Let me go with 1964?
Oh, 1962. Opened by the Queen in 1962.
Yes, of course, because you had the 50th anniversary as well last year.
So, but actually, obviously, volunteering at a hospital has been traditionally something that volunteers do. And our longest-serving volunteer has been at Addenbrookes for 48 years. So, obviously, she was on the previous site opposite the Fitzwilliam Museum.
Dare I ask how old this person is?
No. All I can say is that the ages of volunteers age from 16 for the youngest to people in their 90s.
And are these people recognised for the years of service that
they are.
Give
we, have
well?
A, we have a lunch, a very nice lunch every year, and we have long service awards there. So, yes, so 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and then going up to... Obviously, this person's nearly 50 years, so that's great.
So you yourself as part of a team in voluntary services,
we're
then?
We're a small team, yes.
How many of you?
We're three of us and an apprentice, so we're just a small team down there in the basement.
But you're paid, presumably?
We are, yes, we are paid
and
members.
And just look
staff.
After the 700 volunteers as
that's
well?
That's right, we do. Our role is to obviously recruit people into the hospital, to run induction programmes, to run training. My particular role, I'm very interested in making the right placements for people to get the right placement when they come in, and obviously to change that. Obviously, sometimes people want to change, so we can do that too. We've got lots of different roles that we can offer people.
You've talked about a myriad of different facets of areas of being able to volunteer from, as you mentioned earlier on. I mean, some of my favourites are Pets as Therapy as well, or the Pat Dogs, as we call them, P-A-T
Pat
as
dogs,
well.
Pat Dogs, very popular. Yeah.
Met some of those as well.
Yes.
Always very cute, because they wear their high visibility vests,
they
don't
do,
they
do,
as
they
well.
Do. And they also have their own ID badge. You know, staff and volunteers have the ID badges with photos. Well, it's quite fun trying to get a pat dog to sit in the right place for the photo. Depending on the size of the pat dog can be quite difficult, actually.
Very sweet, because it says, my name is Patch, and there's a little photograph of the poodle or
but
whatever.
But they quite often lose them, and they're quite often found.
Not the dogs, the IDs.
No, not the dogs. The dog badges, they get because obviously they wear them on their collars, and they tend to fall off.
How does that work, Anna? Because the hospital, of course, is very, very tight, as we know, about hygiene. So how does the pat dogs actually work?
Well, the pat dogs, they do have to get permission from the ward sisters to go onto the wards, and there are some wards that they wouldn't be able to go on. So that's how they do have go in certain areas of the hospital and not others. So they're just guided by whoever's in charge of the ward on the day.
It must be great therapy for someone psychologically to,
it's really good
to be able to have an animal like a... They may have left a pet at home and been in hospital now for days, weeks even, just to be able to have something that they feel comforted by, to have a lovely sort of gentle... These are wonderful docile dogs as well. Some of them quite big,
They actually have to do... Some are big, some are small. They do have to go through training with pets as therapy before they can come to us as volunteers.
The keepers or owners. Maybe the dogs have
done it. The dogs that get the test.
Dogs are trained before they can...
to be tested for temperament.
Oh,
Because they mustn't grab food, that type of thing. So, they all have to go through quite a rigorous test before.
They wouldn't so much grab patients as
about how they take food and how gentle they are. So they have to go through all their tests, and they have to come into us with the owners come to us with their certificate, and then the owners go through the normal program for the interviewing and the induction. But obviously, the dog has already done their bit with pets therapy.
So you can do some tasks that may seem more menial, but are very, very meaningful, really, such as you need newspaper volunteers as well.
We do, yes. We've got the newspaper volunteers, very, very useful for people. I did nurse on the ward, so I'm very aware that patients are really looking forward to their newspapers. And they quite often don't realise it's volunteers that bring the newspapers round. Because sometimes the volunteer will get told off if they're not there on time. They'll say, actually, I'm volunteering. But no, it's a great role. And it's not just about selling a newspaper. It's about talking to people on the wards as well. So that's a really good role.
And you work quite closely with the Red Cross as well.
We do. The Red Cross volunteers come in and then they can do their hand massage and the manicures and that type of pampering. So that's very nice.
And I think two or three times a week as well, a trolley goes around with sort of sweets and chocolates.
Oh, that's the WRVS trolley. Yes, very nice. Came down into our department the other day. We were all very excited, all the chocolates and things on there.
WRVS, you should explain what that stands for.
That actually stands for the Women's Royal Voluntary Service. So yes, that's a national organisation. And they run the cafes, the large cafes on site. Some of them, there are obviously many cafes on site at Addenbrookes, but there's a large one in outpatients that's run by WRVS.
And they're all volunteers,
Volunteers. And although what's in a name, because you do get men volunteers as well as women volunteers in the WRVS.
I was wondering whether to ask that question. So they obviously just have not changed the title of the organisation. It remains women's.
I heard that might change actually in the future. Hmm. So I think they're talking about that.
The RVS, maybe, just Raw Voluntary Service.
Exactly, yes.
Do you still have the flower arrangers? Because I know with hygiene as well, that
the
was a
problem. Flower girls, I mean, there were fewer flower girls than there were. At one point, there were many, many flower girls that would go on and have particular tabards and would go around the wards. But as you're quite right, a lot of the wards don't have flowers now, so we don't recruit for flower girls. We still have a few flower girls that go and do the flowers, though, and there are still some flowers out there.
Do you find sometimes patients are particularly lonely? Maybe they don't have family, or maybe they have family in Manchester or Birmingham, a long way away that can't visit.
Yes.
So do you sort of focus or any dedicated time from a volunteer with any particular one-to-one relationship with a patient?
Well, volunteers can be visitors where they'll just go out and just literally go around to the wards and find out who hasn't got a visitor, and we'll sit and listen and talk. Perhaps look at a magazine or look at some photographs. And they can do that in a way. They can be a visitor and they can go around all the different wards, or you can have a ward helper role where you're placed on a particular ward. And then you get to know, obviously, the area and the staff that work in that ward. And then you're there for... You'll get to know who would perhaps like to, some company and to chat. And the thing with a volunteer is that they have time to listen. Staff are very busy, and sometimes the staff are in the middle of a conversation and they get called away. Whereas the whole thing of volunteer, one, they're a volunteer, they have a different relationship with the patient, and the other thing is they've got the time to actually sit and listen.
There's
and
the personal all the way through interface, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah. And that's what the volunteers, they tell me that's what they really enjoy, that they get a chance to, and they hear really interesting stories as well. I mean, it's a two-way thing. They hear really interesting stories. And obviously, it's a hospital. Sometimes there are sad stories, but actually, sometimes there are good stories, and there's a lot of laughter. And people like to laugh on the wards, you know, that people like to have a good time. So, you know, that it's not all sad stories, but sometimes it is. It's about listening to people and gauging what they want, really. And that's what our volunteers are very good at doing.
There's a certain inevitability of old age. It's really generally patients are people over the age of 55. Let's face it, we get older, we wear out, and
exactly,
we conk out,
yes,
things happen to
yes
us.
And if you're stuck upstairs in a hospital bed, for example, a volunteer can sometimes take you down to the concourse and just get you off the ward for a little while. And that's another lovely thing that...
And older people can be so interesting because they can remember, say, being a Land Army girl if it's an older lady who remembers World War II.
Absolutely. And in fact,
early 1950s.
I was looking back at hospital volunteering and I was thinking, well, what were the earliest hospital volunteers? And I think actually you could go back to World War I when the VADs were recruited to help the nursing staff.
VADs, you know.
They're voluntary aid dispatchments, I think they were called. And they were the women who were recruited to help the wounded soldiers coming back in. The hospitals were overflowing. And of course, Addenbrookes did exist then as a hospital inn.
Down in the old Trumpington Street
site.
Yeah,
that's right. And then they used all parts of Cambridge and the Lee schools and various other places to create wards there. But that's when people actually started to volunteer in a hands-on way in hospital, actually helping the domestic staff and the nursing staff. I think probably before that was more charitable works. But certainly, so from then on, people have been coming in, men and women coming in to actually help the staff run the hospitals and help patients have a better experience in hospital and do those extra things that staff perhaps don't have time to do.
And mealtime volunteering as well. It was a big thing for you a couple of years ago. You were kind of headlining that and trying to get volunteers on that one as well. Mm-hmm. And you're then, she wasn't chief executive, but she was certainly on the board at Addenbrookes, was Lady Mary Archer, of course, Dr.
Yes.
Archer,
yes.
As she was known by you, the colleagues around her. And she actually became a mealtime volunteer as well, didn't she?
She did, yes. She was very, very interested in volunteering at
Addenbrookes. And mealtime volunteering, what would that entail?
So mealtime volunteering now is part of our ward helper role. So people come with us and they want to volunteer on a particular ward, and then we offer them further training, and the further training is with the nutritionists and the dietitians and the speech and language therapists, so then they can learn how to feed patients and what things you need to look out for, and then they go on and can actually feed patients on the ward. If you haven't done the training, there's lots of other things that volunteers can do as well. I mean, with meal times, giving out the meals, unwrapping those bits of cheese that come in those plastic wrappers, yes, that no one can get undone.
That's a challenge for the best of us.
In fact,
at most
exactly,
times.
Exactly. So I don't think I could do that. Yeah. Those types of things that you can do without the training. But those who are interested in the training to go on and be mealed, and most of our volunteers on the wards, they do take up the training. It's very, very good. So that they can do a bit more. It's about empowering volunteers to have more skills to help patients. So we look to create as many sort of training opportunities as we can.
And they did say that, just imagine that somebody that can't actually eat, and obviously the loss of independence there, not being able to use a knife or fork. And part of the training, I think, was to lay someone flat on the back, one of the volunteers that's in training, and to try and eat a dry cream cracker. Have you ever tried to do that?
That's a rumour, Phil.
Is it?
Cruel.
No, the volunteers, so they can get the idea of not being able to...
We don't quite do that.
Okay.
No. What we do, though, in the training session, is feed yoghurt to each other. And one is...
You've done this, haven't you, Anna?
Oh, I've done the training.
Yes.
And you can blindfold someone, so that would... You can imagine what it would be like.
Loss of some of the senses.
Yes, that's right. So, but nothing quite so cruel as dry biscuits.
Now, if this has got some listeners interested as to how they might be able to help and volunteer at Addenbrookes Hospital, we'll be telling you a little bit how you can get in touch with Anna and her department and her team right after this.
Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Cambridge 105, Sunday Breakfast with Phil Rose, with my guest Anna Ellis from Voluntary Services, a department at the hospital looking after the administration, looking after volunteers in turn, and the new incumbents as well. Having listened to the show so far this morning, Anna, do you think, well, I know there'll be some people that'll be interested in volunteering. How should they go about contacting you if they are?
Right, well, lots of different ways that you can contact us and me. You can go to the website, so you can just put Addenbrookes into your search engine, go onto the website, and you can follow the link for working for us and then volunteering, and you can apply online that way. You can email us at volunteer@addenbrookes.nhs.uk, or you can telephone, which is Cambridge 586 616. So be delighted to hear from anybody. I'd like to say thank you as well to any listeners out there who are volunteering at the moment at the hospital.
And we should say your background as well is in nursing, and you mentioned it a little earlier on, but you were one of the Addenbrookes nurses as well.
Yes, up on the oncology ward, up on D9 for nearly 3 years nursing up there. So, yes, so I have an understanding, a little understanding of how the wards work. I was also a patient for quite a long time. When I was 18, I had a horse riding accident and broke quite a few bones. So I was on the wards there for a few months as a patient. So
you're a local girl, and you're from the Cambridge area?
Yes.
Originally?
Yeah.
So why the sort of mood change or the swing from nursing into voluntary services?
Ah, well, that was just, bad feet, really. You need good feet to be a nurse. And my feet were, I had an operation that wasn't very good.
It's a practical issue for you.
Practical issue, yeah.
Lots of standing and lifting moving around the wards.
You need to be on your feet all the time when you're nursing.
You're doing a wonderful job as you are, along with your team of other three others. You have a manager that looks after the...
Giles,
I met him as well.
Yes.
He's a lovely guy as well. So hopefully we can get some more volunteers. Just... one more summary, really, of the areas or facets that you can volunteer in. There's a huge list I have here, but I know you probably want to go through that.
The thing is, they're always changing. The roles are always changing, so it's always worth contacting us. And we do try and match up our volunteers with a suitable role. Sometimes we can't do it immediately, but we usually can find something for people. So it really is worth asking and saying what you're interested in. But our popular roles are things like ward helpers, clinic helpers, guides to show people around. We've talked about newspaper sellers and library volunteers. And then we've got some behind-the-scenes roles as well with admin, and volunteers quite often help staff at events. So lots of different roles. Things changing all the time.
And gardening as well.
Gardening, yes, a little bit of gardening. So the weather's getting better for that, isn't it?
You have some small garden areas. I think there's one called the Jubilee Garden,
isn't
there?
There is, yes.
And that needs to be tended and looked after as well. And that's been done and looked after by volunteers as well.
That's right, yeah.
There are a few prerequisites as well if you do want to volunteer as well. And we should be talking about enhanced CRB checks, I guess.
We do. We interview everybody who comes in. We do then need to do, it's called DBS now rather than, it's debarring service rather than CRB.
I didn't know it's
the same. It's the same.
DBS. No, we're all DBS, yeah. Darling. Okay, all right.
But it's the same thing. And we do take up references as well. So volunteers do have to go through a similar recruitment process to staff. And there is an induction as well before you can start volunteering. And then we like to try and get new volunteers shadowing existing volunteers, so they get some experience rather than being on their own.
And are there any occupational health checks as well?
We do, yes, you're quite right. It's like being at work.
It is, isn't it?
We do, yes, immunisation checks and the health declaration form as well. So we do all that, yeah. So it is very much like the process that staff go through.
But we shouldn't let that put anybody
absolutely
off from applying.
Absolutely, it's just a process that's gone through. It's just the admin.
We have to say from close hand here in this studio, we thoroughly enjoy, the cat's out of the bag now, we do a bit of volunteering there and we find it thoroughly fulfilling, especially meeting the patients as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Anna, thank you very much for coming in this morning, explaining a little bit about voluntary services at Addenbrookes. In fact, Rosie as well, 1,025 beds, I believe.
It's over 1,000, I know that.
Statistics off the top of my head this time.
Yes, well done. And
of course, we shall swell to 3 hospitals by 2016 when the plans for Papworth to come over onto the site as well.
That's right.
So it's going to be a truly massive place as well, and the Children's Hospital.
In the
as
future,
well.
Yes, that's
mind
right.
Boggles how large the site will become. Yep. Thanks very much for giving up some time this morning and meeting us. Lovely having you in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Bye.
No corporate guys looking over our shoulders. We think it's good to be part of the community. This is your Cambridge 105.